There was a guy I spoke to who said, you need to pretend like just one day you flip the lights on and you're there. Website needs to be there.
Right.
Facebook page needs to be there. A video needs to be there. Photos need to be there. You need to have something recorded. So like, yes, you just walk into the room, you flip the switch on, and there is new deco. It has a presence. It has a life. Uh-huh. So part of this idea of bringing the musicians in was to say, hey, we're going to make this video. We're going to record a couple pieces. We're going to record a couple audio things. We're going to record some video things. We're going to do some interviews. It's a whole day of picture, everything.
Like, nice.
We invested a lot of money in pretending like we were an organization that already existed and was alive. Smart. So that we can go, blip, and then all of a sudden we're there. Everything there. Photos, audio, video, website, Facebook page, all of it. And that was like a really good piece of advice because it gave us a focus to like really just get it done and make it happen. And he was right. We were in the finals and we were just like, we're going to do this anyway.
Yeah.
And then through that process of just, you know, pulling down from the universe, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We ended up getting that grant after. But once we flipped the lights on, we're there.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out DistroKid.com. What's going on? Welcome to the New Music Business Podcast. I'm your host, Ari Herstand, author of How to Make It in the New Music Business, the book. Today, my guests are Giacomo Byros and Sam Hyken of the New Deco Ensemble based in Miami, Florida. This episode is for all you orchestra nerds out there. I am guilty of that. I played an orchestra most of my life. For those of you who don't know, I'm a trumpet player too. And I love going to the LA Phil in LA and love orchestra music. So the New Deco Ensemble actually does something quite different. So they were formed in 2015, and they are an eclectic orchestra. They have members from all over the country, and they're known for doing collaborations with pretty big artists such as Ben Folds, Jacob Collier, Kimbra, Wyclef, Kishibashi, Corey Henry, Stephen Marley, Emily King, to name a few. Their upcoming season starts October 29th, and this year, obviously in the COVID era, it's going to be quite different. They don't get to have their live audience. They're going to be live streaming all of their performances, but the orchestra will be together, COVID safe. Their manager is Andrew Lieb of Red Light Management. You might remember Andrew from being on a previous episode of this show. So this episode was actually recorded this past February. So months back, right before the shutdown, this was actually right before or after, I don't remember, Andrew, Giacomo, and Sam and I all went to the Grammys together. This season that's coming up includes collaborations with Jose James, Larkin Poe, Corey Wong of Wolfpack, Corey Henry, and Richard Bona. They also are doing arrangements of music by Led Zeppelin, Pharrell Williams, Duke Ellington, The Beach Boys, George Gershwin and John Adams, Earth, Wind & Fire, Valerie Coleman, Dr. Dre. This is going to be a great season, and I'm actually really interested to see how they pull it off. But we get into their story, and obviously this was before they knew they were going virtual, but they have a really interesting story. So as always, please follow and subscribe and like this show, however you're listening to this. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Ari Herstand. You can follow the show and the company and everybody behind the scenes at Ari's Take. That's just at Ari's Take on Instagram and Twitter as well. Also follow the New Deco Ensemble on all the socials. It's just at New Deco Ensemble. Visit aristake.com and sign up for the email list. If you're not on that email list, you are missing out. This is where I send all the most interesting, most important information about the new music business that you need to know. Sign up on the email list. That is at aristake.com. All right, let's kick into the show. Giacomo, Sam, what's up? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Thanks for
having
us.
Yeah, and welcome to LA.
Yeah.
This is, so you're based in Miami.
Yes.
And you've been in LA now just a few days, right? And this is exciting because for people listening, we sat right next to each other at the Grammys and, you know, rocked out to Usher's Prince tribute and Billie Eilish and all of that. It was your first Grammys, right?
First one.
How was that? What was that experience like?
It was incredible. It was just amazing to see all the phenomenal acts. I mean, for me, like my junior high self, seeing Aerosmith performing with Run DMC was really unbelievable.
Oh,
and
man.
Just the pairings and to see that live and just to see all these amazing artists kind of all in one fell swoop at one show.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience of just being in the Grammys and, you know, especially being in LA. I mean, it was a really deep moment, you know, after everything that happened with Kobe, but being in the Staples Center as in the first public moment was really powerful and incredibly sad, but really just, it was just amazing to be there.
Right, because Kobe Bryant had just passed away that morning, 5 hours before the Grammys started. And so it kind of turned into a big tribute to Kobe.
Right, exactly.
Did you grow up watching basketball or anything like that?
Both of us are big basketball fans.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, what a night. And you, so New Deco has actually collaborated with quite a few Grammy nominees and winners of this year. I know right before we walked in, you ran into a former collaborator / Grammy winner of the evening, Jake Collier. So I watched that performance, the Jacob Collier, which was incredible, the one that's online right now, the YouTube one. And there are so many things that stuck out to me about that one in particular. I mean, for one, Jacob's compositions in and of themselves are so complex. There's already so much going on. I'm curious, Sam, how you approach something like that and then what you take when you arrange it into a full orchestration, because already there's so much happening, but I'm curious, like, what you choose to hone in on and what you pull from. Is there much collaboration with the artist? Like, did you work with Jacob on the arrangement, or did he just show up and you guys just ran through what you've done?
So with the artists that we collaborate with, it's varying degrees of how much they want to be part of the collaboration process.
Okay.
With some, there's a back and forth. When we had Wyclef Jean, he actually went to the studio and recorded new remixes, new versions of the songs that we did with him.
No shit.
With Jacob, we were actually doing pre-written arrangements that he had done with Metropole, but I just took them and adapted them from New Deco. So Metropole is a big band that has strings. It's a much smaller winds and brass section for us, but we do have a larger complement of percussion. So I was able to take the arrangements and make them almost like more classical sounding isn't the right word, but when you replace saxophones with bassoon and oboe, it's just going to have a bit of a different touch to it.
Cool.
So ours have lean more to the orchestra side than the big band side.
Gotcha. And so for like Wyclef, for instance, you said he recorded, went before the performance and recorded some of this?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
He went to the studio and he would either like do a remix or a mashup. He took, we did Hips Don't Lie with Shakira. And he actually put Drake's, was it One Dance? Like first, it's just giving me right now, but that Drake song on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took what Wyclef did and orchestrated and add my own lines to it.
Cool. So, because you arrange every piece that you guys do?
All the guests are, well, not every single piece.
Okay.
We do a lot of living composers and original music as well.
Cool.
But all of the guest artists that come in and all of the reimaginings of contemporary artists like Outkast and Daft Punk, those are the arrangements that I do or do with members of our ensemble in collaboration.
I watched and listened to, and like the audio production is phenomenal too, and the video production. I mean, it's like a full-on thing, which is great. And is that all? And I noticed something else while I was watching this, and this was really interesting. I want to ask you like how this functions live in the hall. It seemed that nearly every instrument was individually mic'd.
Yes. That's true. Yes, we do not do any zone miking with New Deco. It's all of our strings are all on DPAs.
Is that just for the recording, or is that like piped?
It's for live
the
sound. It's for live sound as well. It's a combination for both. It's one of our as Giacomo would say, the ethos of New Deco. One of our rules is that everything we do is amplified at the higher level.
Wow.
We're a 21st century orchestra. We're trying to create a 21st century sound. And our audio team, we list them really as part of the musicians, and we consider them like a member of the ensemble because what they do is so critical to the sound of what New Deco is.
So when you're in the house and you're experiencing, how many piece orchestra is this? 30?
Yeah, we range from as little as we have a smaller version, which is about a 17 piece, okay, all the way up to when we're playing in large PA performing arts centers.
Yeah.
At the Arts Center, we do almost around a 40 piece.
Wow. So you're experiencing 40 piece orchestra individually mic'd coming through these speakers. I mean, are there orchestras that do that anywhere else? I mean, I go to the LA Phil. They don't do that.
Very rarely. There's an orchestra in that's been around for quite some time in London called the Heritage Orchestra that does amplification.
Okay.
And I'm not sure, honestly, if Metropole is amplifying or not, but it's, for us, the amplification is not just the balancing of the instruments, but actually like the sound that we're creating.
Well, that's the other thing, because the sound, and Giacomo, I want to bring it to you with this, because the first thing I noticed was the pocket, actually. So, because, and the drummer, like the kit player and the bassist, first off, who are these motherfuckers? Because these
they're
guys,
bad boys.
Yeah. They are bad.
Yeah.
Holy shit. I mean, and they just like, and I was so astounded at how deep the pocket is, yeah, with the orchestra that's falling right into it along with them. Like normally you're like, oh, a funk band's got a deep pocket, or you know, you got an R&B outfit or something like that, and they're grooving hard. But you don't anticipate a 30-piece orchestra on top of that being able to fall into the groove. So how do you work with that, and like how much, you know, do you give those players and then kind of bring the orchestra? Like, how do you do that?
Yeah, I think it's all been very organic, right?
Okay.
So when we first started the group, we didn't have quite the rhythm section that exists as it is now.
Yeah.
But over time, we've developed this incredible sound through just trial and error in a lot of ways. And as we brought more and more rhythm section guys in and like really became this hybrid ensemble from going from like this new music-y, you know, contemporary orchestra that had electric guitar and stuff when it was needed or felt like it was going to be important. But the suites caught fire so much that Sam was creating that rhythm section really evolved. And as it evolved, those guys got better and better at playing with each other, listening with each other, and then learning how to listen to strings. One of the conversations I've had many times with our drummer is like how the nuance of strings and how they react are a lot different than your typical instrument that they would normally play with.
Sure.
So they're listening in new, more nuanced, intense ways. And our drummer is so good at like understanding how to, you know, he didn't study like classical music per se in the way we did, but he has such astounding ears. He's able to like fold the way he plays and the way to be in a pocket in with strings. And they've been to him too. And you mentioned the groove of the bass player, you know.
Yeah.
The more people like work together and groove together and go through the fire together, the more they are going to be able to connect and have synergy together. And we've gone through so many concerts where we've put those guys on the toes, put them playing music that had to read the charts in a new and different way. You know, Dale, our bass player, can obviously sit in the pocket and jam and do all the kind of great stuff we need, but he also can play classical music too. So it just has really evolved over time. And that relationship between the musicians and myself, especially the rhythm section, and we were talking this weekend, Armando and I just look at each other and we know what we're saying now.
He's the drummer?
Yeah. He looks at me, he knows I need it softer or faster or louder or slower or more chill. Like, I don't even have to, like, I can barely make a nudge and he gets it. And and that's something that's really special you find with like big orchestras like the Chicago Symphony or Concertgebouw. And they look at a conductor in a way and the conductor makes an eye motion. It could be physical, it could be facial, it could be body, but it all comes from deep within. And when the musicians are really connected to you and you have this relationship with them, especially an orchestra that you've been conducting normally for a while, then there's this really sort of interspecies communication that starts to happen. And people really like start to bond and trust each other. And I think we've built a big trust between Sam, the writing, my musicianship, the musician's musicianship, all combining together. That trust has been building for 5 years. And it's exciting because we're just really finding that groove that's making us do what we do. And it just shows that the future is we're going to get even more in that sort of pocket of understanding each other.
Right, the pocket of understanding each other, but the pocket of the groove.
I love that.
So have all of these players, or have a lot of them been there since the beginning?
I mean, it's evolved a bit. There's some people have been there from the beginning. Some people move away. Things have changed. Things happen. Life is life. But for the most part, a lot of the people who started with us in the orchestra are I've been there. We have a bassoon player. I think he's missed one show because he was deathly sick, you know. So people are really dedicated.
Yeah.
But, you know, things change and happen as you grow. When you have 30 pieces, people come in and out. But there's been a real dedication by our musicians to want to stay and grow and see where it goes. They felt the energy a couple years ago. They knew something special was happening, something magical was happening with all of us. They trusted Sam and I. Sam and I have really worked hard to not only earn their trust, but keep their trust, keep things transparent so they see where it's all going, update them on what we're trying to do, bring out positivity, and just kind of reflect with them. You know, we do this a lot before a show. We have like pre-concert talks where it's part hype, part thank you, part inspirational, because we're so proud of not only what they're doing, but what it's doing for the community, and we want to make sure they understand that, and that feeds into everyone just wanting to do the best they can pressuring them, you know, or something.
Right, right. No, I mean, they seem very at ease just by watching it and listening. It just like, it feels comfortable. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, that's the other thing is just like, I mean, for me, you know, going to the orchestra, going to see an orchestra, no matter what kind is it, whether it's the LA Phil or whomever, to me, it's all about the feel. And I just like, when I go, it's just like, it's just, what am I feeling while I'm in it? And so like, even just listening to it through my headphones, not being there, like I could tell like the feeling, there was an ease. There was just an ease amongst the players. And then watching it, I mean, people are smiling, people are laughing, people are joking, they're looking at you. You're like, I mean, it's just like, it feels a lot more laid back than you expect from like your typical orchestra. No one's in a tux. I mean, you know, it's like, it's a lot more chill. I mean, that's like the 21st century orchestra feel, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that chillness is because we are really working hard to be dedicated, prepared for shows. We do everything we can to give every tool to the musician so that they can do their best and be their best. And hopefully when it comes to concert time, it's more like inspirational.
Yeah.
In a way, the concert's kind of the icing on the cake. I think what's really exciting, and Sam can speak to this more for himself, but like learning to get into the music of the collaborator we're working with and writing the music, he always says he really dives into who they are. Me working with the musicians that week, we really are just tooth and nail going through like the muck together to fix things. And then the concert comes, it's just like, we're just letting it all out, and it's like the icing on the cake. The real work's done before the concert. So if you prepared and you give them all the tools they need, then, you know, hopefully the concert is like an inspirational moment.
It's also something we stress to our musicians as well, because the feedback that we get from our audience is exactly what you said, is that we love coming to your concerts because your musicians look like they're having the best time.
Yeah.
And so that's what we stress to them like before a concert. I'll say it in our, or either of us will say it in our pre-concert remarks, which is just like, the joy of your face, is the joy of your expression is palpable to our audience and is equally or more important than the execution itself.
Yeah, yeah.
We feed off of it, for sure.
And our audience does too.
So let's talk about the rehearsal process and everything that comes beforehand. So once you let's just talk for a featured artist that you're gonna have. How far in advance are you preparing basically for their appearance? Like, you know, when do you confirm it? When you confirm them, you know, then what happens?
Well, we're trying to be more diligent in terms of preparing earlier with the artist, but you know, we'll confirm them hopefully in the beginning of the season, and then we'll speak to them a good couple months out.
Okay.
And Giacomo and I and the guest artist will collaborate on the set list, and then from there, oftentimes it's usually about a week before, a week and a half before the show, depending on schedule, that the arrangements will begin. They usually finish up about the, if we start rehearsal on Monday, they're coming in sometimes on that Monday.
Sure.
The musicians are getting them Monday or Tuesday, and we'll do a couple rehearsals with just musicians. And then we bring the guest artist in the day before, a sound check, and then we're off.
How long does it take for you to do the arrangements?
So I'm a pretty fast worker.
Okay.
I'll start them about a week before. If we're doing four or five arrangements, six, it just really depends on the artist. It can be through a weekend, but I'm generally working pretty fast on them.
Okay, wow. And then you said two rehearsals with just the musicians typically or so?
Well, you made me think of something with the pocket and the groove. We do have a rhythm sectional usually at the top of the week.
Yeah.
Because we've always felt and what we've learned, especially not only with Nudeco and other orchestras that Sam and I work with, is that if the rhythm section is locked in, loaded, ready to go the musicians, the orchestral musicians, the ones that aren't playing in grooves like that can just sit on it mm-hmm. and like bask in that and mm-hmm. like just feel free to be within that framework. Mm. But the rhythm section was really crucial to getting the style, the suites that he comes up with, the arrangements all sort of like locked in mm-hmm. and then everyone just sits on it. So it makes the rehearsal process go a lot faster. Like we used cool. to waste a lot of time in our regular rehearsals trying to get everyone locked in.
Yeah.
We've learned that these rhythm sectionals are crucial to the rest of the week. After that, depending on the lift of the week, usually it's another, three, four rehearsals yeah. with the full ensemble mm-hmm. before the concert time. And then generally the last two rehearsals, the guest artist comes in and joins
right.
in. So while we're doing music of living composers and working on the suites, maybe the first couple nights kind of diving into that stuff, we usually bring in the guest artist like the second to last rehearsal mm-hmm. and usually give them their time to work it out with the orchestra. And then the dress rehearsal is just kind of a run through.
Do you send the artists in advance the arrangements?
Like a MIDI mock-up?
Yeah, MIDI mock-up.
It depends
or
on
like
the
that.
Artist. When we, okay. when we were working with Tune Yards, like Meryl really wanted to collaborate. So I was sending the arrangements back and forth. Or Aaron Parks, jazz pianist. He wanted to give feedback on it. Mm-hmm. I think those were pretty much the only two times I've actually sent the arrangement.
Okay.
Because, part of what makes the experience magical, especially is if the artist really has no idea what to expect and they get sure. to hear it all for the first time, their music played by an orchestra.
Yeah.
That experience for them is very magical.
Cool. And do you write in the moments when you know that an artist can rip or something like that? Be like, all right, PJ, you're gonna go here.
Yeah. I mean, we definitely will. I mean, I generally will take the form. I study both the record version mm-hmm. and I look at live version. I look at the record mm-hmm. version for a lot of the creative ideas. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes I'll orchestrate like a really interesting guitar lick and give the guitarist just chords to comp on. Mm. And that way, for the artist, that it's really recognizable and it's kind of home base for them.
Cool.
And then I'll go on YouTube and just, if the artist doesn't have a live set available, I'll just go on to YouTube and find a live version so I can know how they perform it and, nice. And what are the areas that they do take time or solos or whatnot. And cool. then when they come in, they're playing on top of the form that they're used to. And then, especially now that we're on iPads, we're able, if, we have Corey Henry say, hey, we want to do this verse one more time or we want to go back, we're able to make those adjustments on the fly pretty easily.
Nice. That was also something I was interested. How much is written out? I mean, obviously for the strings, every note is written out, but like for guitar, bass, drums, like right. how much is written?
It really depends. A lot of times I'll just give chords or slashes for drums and yeah. very light instructions. But if I want something specific or I think that there's some a specific pattern I want to play, I'll usually just write as is on top of the part or like with a guitar.
Okay.
If there's a line I want them to specifically play, I'll just say like with bassoon so they understand that this I play and then the rest is chords and they'll have freedom. But we're in communication during rehearsal and we can say, that's just for reference, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you send any of the players the original song,
yes.
the live versions, all of that for reference?
Yes, okay. I do. At the beginning of every week, I'll send our rhythm section the set list and I'll give them reference recordings. I'll say, if the live version is a different tempo or a different feel, I say reference this version, et cetera.
Cool. And in terms of tempos, are you sticking pretty close to the original tempo of the record, or how do you go with that?
I find that I like to use the live tempos a little bit better because okay. that it seems to match the energy that the artist wants to perform.
Sure.
And that's the tempo that I'll usually put on there. Mm-hmm. But it depends. Once they get there, if it feels, with the orchestral arrangement, if it feels slower, it's something that we'll kind of figure out during the week. It's not Sweet. Really an absolute ever.
Cool. Honestly, tempo I've learned over the years, there's little minute variations in tempo that make sense for a different space you're playing in. Mm. Like if something, a really big hall, sometimes you got to push things a little bit faster.
Oh, interesting.
Sometimes a small hall, maybe you want to drop it one or two BPMs. It's very nuanced and very minor. And actually it's something I learned in the classical world. But I feel like there's something to that. And he's right. The live experience, artists who sing songs over and over and over again tend to get a little quicker as they go throughout
yeah,
their life.
That makes
and,
sense.
And so things pick up.
Do you find any consistency with artists who are coming in when they're performing with an orchestra? They've never done this before. Do they tend to push or do they tend to drag?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, honestly, the rhythm section just lays it down.
Okay.
I can only think
so
they
tend to sit.
Yeah.
Well, I've only literally, I can maybe count on a handful of an artist saying, can you punch that up a little bit, or can you give that drummer a little coffee or something? Yeah. You know, like it's only happened like once or twice that I specifically remember an artist really being unhappy with tempo. Usually, I have to look back at Sam's faster or slower because he's been living with the arrangement and the
Gotcha.
And honestly, the iPads have really helped because I can just go bloop bloop and hit the tempo before. Usually on my paper, I'm like pulling out my metronome and this. Now I can secretly like check my tempos and make sure I'm like right there.
Nice.
And if it needs to go faster, it needs to go faster. And everything is all, you know, once something comes off the grid and becomes organic with a human, there's the human element. And and sometimes, as amazing as our rhythm section is, they might be like just wanting to sit that day. And so you just got to kind of push it forward a little bit sometimes.
So it's
really about the vibe and checking in with the artist to make sure that they're really happy with what they're feeling.
Nice. Sam, you said that you, so in part of your research with the artist, other than just the musical research of the songs with the live versions, recorded versions, what other research are you doing of the artist that informs your decision on the arrangement?
It's a lot of listening, and I mean, it's listening to as many versions as possible, honestly. Like, I really try and find, you know, go kind of across the board. Like, listen, if an artist has a tiny desk, and a lot of times when we talk to artists, we say, hey, you know, we love this on tiny desk because it's the version that you want to do. So you know, for me, or another example of that, when Corey Henry came, listened to his jam in the van, his tiny desk, and totally two different complete versions. So, you know, I had emailed him and said, hey, I noticed that at the end of this, you like to swing it a bit. You know, how would you like to do it here? You know, that those kinds of, you know, really digging in and trying to find the depth of you know, what will make that set special.
So Corey Henry, for instance, one of the most renowned living keyboard players right now, grew up in the church. You know, that viral video I think we've all seen of him at the organ in a church somewhere. As a young kid. I'm more interested in kind of the artist's whole story and kind of, so like a lot of listening, you look at their tiny desk and all of that. In terms of their influences or the styles or their history or their location or where they're from or any of that, is that kind of is that part of the process at all? Or
I mean, I think, and Giacomo always says this in our intro call to the artist, but you know, what's important is really showing the diversity of an artist and kind of showing their whole palette. I think that's like probably one of the most important that we like to do. Not like a whole career retrospective, but really show the range and dynamicism of the artists that come.
Cool. Do you choose the songs or do they?
We do it in collaboration. Oh, okay. You know, often our artists will say, which songs do you want to do? And we say, what songs do you want to do? And we want their experience to really be a dream come true for them. We want them to come down and it to be, you know, a heavenly experience.
Yeah.
When Corey came down, both Jacqueline and I really loved the new EP that he did, and he had just come out with a project. So, you know, for artists to get to do their new music, especially with an orchestra, and have that new piece of content alongside a new project, it's something that we love to champion as well.
We also had artists who came in with a certain idea, a certain specific thing that they were like just on at that moment and wanted to do, but it didn't really make sense in terms of working with us because it didn't show their range or their total vocabulary. While one or two of the songs might have been cool, it would have stayed in a certain realm that I think didn't show them off the best. So if we feel that way, or if we feel the set is like really not going in the direction that we think shows them off the best, we just explain it to them. Like, this is why we want this song. This is why we're thinking of this. This is what's going to be great. Honestly, a lot of it, personally, and this has always been a little bit of my thing, is how does New Deco and Sam's writing in particular, how does it also show off these musicians? Because we never want to be a backup band to anybody. It's all in collaboration. So how does the sound of New Deco blend in with this particular arrangement or artist in a way that shows everyone off on an equal bill?
Okay, so that's really interesting. Now, that New Deco has an identity, and that now you're working in collaboration with this artist. You're not just backing up the artist.
Right,
right.
Let's go into that a little bit deeper. What is the identity of New Deco?
Ooh, well, that we really have no wall or ceiling, you know, that we can drop on a dime on any style and any genre and really just turn around and go from something that's soulful and funky or has a hip-hop vibe to something that's really lush and beautiful and has maybe some Ravel, Debussy vibes, all within the same context of a particular artist. And you know, while an artist may be a certain genre, I think we can help bring out and pull out the styles within their genre through all the styles that we feel really comfortable in. But at the end of the day, the orchestra itself is such an incredible vehicle for musical expression. There's no really boundaries that we have. So we really try to impress upon that to the artist. Like, we can do anything you want. We can create a sound world that's anything, as long as you are cool with how we do it or some of the ideas. And then, honestly, Sam, like, will find his moments to show off the string section, show off the violins. We always call it Heikenize. He's got these little, like, licks for the violin that are, like, really, like, just, I don't know, they have, like, some...
Like disco.
Just something disco that can, like, show off people, you know, or put solos in a certain place, or the brass in a certain way. And that gives it a certain flavor that ultimately becomes us, you know?
Yeah, to add to that, sometimes, you know, we'll substitute what would be on the live or record, like a guitar or keyboard solo, as like a string feature or like just an orchestral feature, or toss in a bridge or an outro, and like anything that we can do to really make the arrangements our own and special.
Cool. And then when you're bringing the artist in, if the arrangements have taken a life of their own, like, is this something, do you give the artist music for them to kind of help keep them on track of what's happening with it, or is they pretty much all the artists are off book by the time
we've never given sheet music to one artist. Okay. I mean, oftentimes they'll record rehearsals so they can, if there's like a form question, and they just, you know, if there's like a little bit of a extra moment, just so they're clear on it.
It's funny, some artists say, oh, we'll just take it off the record. We take it off the record, and they're like, well, that's now it's done. I'm like, well, that's because you've been touring that song for 3 years, and it changes. You go to this one club, we're gonna take this 8 bars out, and then, but that's the cool thing, is that we can say to musicians, okay, we're out in measures 51 through 59, which and then like we can fix it up really fast. So usually that first rehearsal with the guest artist is where they kind of get comfortable with what has been written and add stuff or not add stuff. I mean, we're always adding repeats, we're always adding like vamp sections. We're tweaking to the very end.
Cool. So you're based in Miami. You've always been in Miami. You formed in Miami?
We formed in Miami, yes.
And what brought you guys to Miami? Why Miami?
Well, I don't know how far back. I'm from Miami. I grew up there.
Oh, okay.
I left when I was 15 to go to Interlochen and then to Juilliard. Sam moved there later in his life after a career as an orchestral trumpet player. He joined the New World Symphony. So he's been there like 15 or so years now.
Okay.
So he's fallen in love with the city. And, you know, even when he first moved there, he's like, this is the city we need to be at and plant these seeds. And
cool.
I'd always had a dream to come back to Miami and do something. It was like one of my mom's big things. Like, why don't you come back and create an orchestra? I'm like, it's not that simple.
Right.
But then when I met this guy and we bonded and we had all these ideas and we knew that, you know, there was a lot of synergy between us that we could do something really magical and special. And that was sort of a buildup that started 12 years even before that.
So you guys, you didn't meet in Miami though, right?
No.
You met Singapore.
In Singapore.
Right.
Okay. We were both members of the Singapore Symphony. We joined at the same time. He was the youngest.
On the same day.
Trumpet player.
Wow.
Yeah.
In the history of the orchestra. And I was, you know, I was coming from, you know, my master's degree in Cincinnati. And, we met there, joined the orchestra the same day. We were roommates. Just imagine two American expats living in Singapore, playing in a world-class orchestra, touring the world, but also having a lot of free time on our hands because orchestra did not work that much. So, yes, we got into trouble. Yes, we did a lot of fun things on the side. We were both just like busy bees. He was doing his own thing, like with the radio stations there and writing, and we were just having fun. And the funny thing was, it was the same time the iMac came out for Apple. So, like, all those GarageBand applications first came out, and he would just jump on these things and, like, start creating music. And I was just like, man, he had a really knack for harmony, and then we always talked about what the orchestra could be and our version of what we think it needs to be. And we were writing scripts for conductors, we were putting on our own little side hustles and concerts. I started a youth orchestra. I mean, it was just like a whole bunch of stuff we kept doing.
Yeah.
And then we each, you know, felt the pull, you know, to go and start to spread our wings. And by that point, we had already started to really talk about these ideas.
It was also at a time where, like, the financial struggles of orchestras nationwide became more apparent. Even, like, big orchestras having a hard time. You know, orchestras you would never think. And, you know, both of us started asking ourselves the question, like, what if in 25 years that orchestra that we were going to join were to fold? Like, what would you do then? You know, we're not going to be as competitive to people coming out of conservatory at the time.
Right.
So it made us have these just questions about what is the future of the orchestra, what is the future of music, and where was it going? And those were really the early seeds of what New Deco was.
Real quick, I want to let you know about DistroKid. Well, I'm sure you already know about DistroKid, but they are partners with Ari's Take, and they are a great company that can help get your music distributed to Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all of that. Over a million artists use DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I have distributed some of my music in the past. And something I appreciate about DistroKid, as not just an artist, but someone who studies this space, is they have been one of the most innovative companies over the last 10 years. They came in and completely changed the game. One of the first companies offering unlimited uploads, and now most of the other distributors have had to change their policies to kind of copy and follow suit what DistroKid was doing, and the industry had changed, of course. DistroKid doesn't keep a commission. That means you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings from the DSPs. They also offer payment splitting. They call it splits, something that for me at this point is a deal breaker. I don't want to have to cut checks to all my collaborators and the producers and everybody else that is owed royalties and owed splits from my earnings. DistroKid will cut those checks directly. You can get them to your collaborators to sign up, and then DistroKid will cut all the checks to all your collaborators. And they were one of the first to offer that of the DIY self-service distributors. DistroKid continues to innovate. Check them out. If you need to get your music out there, DistroKid.com.
So that's interesting. So you had envisioned something like what turned into New Deco because you saw the struggles of the modern day orchestra,
yes.
What was happening. And right, I mean, I don't follow orchestra news or anything like that, but like I mean, no one I know, unfortunately, really goes to the orchestra very often.
And you love music.
I love music, and I personally, I do love the LA Phil, and I go when I can, but like none of my friends that I know go, unfortunately. I try to drag them along my birthday or something like that.
And that's
that,
one of the more relevant orchestras in this country that's
right.
Actually extremely successful.
Sure.
They yes. Can be argued as one of the most, if not most,
not
successful
the most,
orchestra
yeah.
For sure.
In America. I mean, and it's still a struggle.
Right. I mean, just to show my love, I mean, for Halloween this year, I was Gustavo Dudamel.
The hair.
Yeah, right, the hair. Yeah. You know, so anyway, two people at the party got it, you know.
Oh, wow.
And he's on like every light post around Los Angeles, but you know, that's just whatever it is. But so that's what's really interesting. Because you know, I do have a lot of string player friends and people who are in orchestras, and they like, you know, people who are from will like fly back to their hometowns or something and play in their orchestra, professional orchestra, which even the professional orchestras of like, gosh, I think it was like Houston or something like that. They are not really paid enough to live on full time. Maybe it wasn't Houston, but like it's just like it's not quite at a level where it's like necessarily even supporting the musicians. A lot of these orchestras, and so a lot of the musicians have side hustles and all that stuff.
100%. And I think, you know, one of the big things with orchestras is keeping and retaining talent. And you mentioned Houston. They actually do pay very well.
Oh, okay.
But they purposely pay very well because they don't want the best of the best to go on to the Phillies and the Chicagos because those are the top dogs.
Yeah.
I mean, cream flows to the top, doesn't matter what. You know,
sure.
A great classical musician may start in a Charlotte and move up to Houston and then end up in a Chicago Symphony one day. That's like the orchestral player's like path and dream.
Gotcha.
But the reality is most of these orchestras, especially these mid-markets, they're going to either be per service orchestras in time or not be able to pay the musicians a full enough salary in order to live and have a, you know, quality of life that they really want. So they teach, they do other stuff on the side. And I would argue that a lot of the big symphony orchestras that do pay these huge, huge fees, end of the day, sometimes musicians get frustrated within those contexts because they're doing the same thing over and over again. Not that it's not beautiful and amazing and incredible.
Of course.
It's just, you know, we wanted to always provide an outlet for musicians that gives them like that diversity of performing. In fact, one of the main reasons we wanted to start it is we felt like the musicians in South Florida in particular did not have a new music ensemble. Like Miami, new music, contemporary art, contemporary everything. Mm. Why is there not a new music ensemble?
Right.
LA, New York has multiple. Like Miami should have one that's really badass and is slick and can kill it. And that was the genesis that led to where we are now, which is we still have that part of us, but we also have really expanded and just kind of taken the idea of what the orchestra can be and just really kind of blew it out of the water.
So getting started with an orchestra in Miami, How do you even go about that?
You have a party and get them really drunk.
I mean, there was a Giacomo and I took a good amount of time to figure out exactly what we wanted to do, and even that's changed since then. But coming up with a mission statement, we actually had a friend. We've had several friends that have started groups and that were not the model, but the impetus in a way.
Okay.
But Giacomo had a friend that started an orchestra in Dallas, and we got on the call with him, and we're like, so how do you start an orchestra? How do you start, you know, what does it mean to start a not-for-profit? And it's, you have to write a mission statement. That's the first thing. And then articles of incorporation. And it was like all the kind of the steps to like not-for-profit 101. Mm. And we just started just checking off those steps. We took time. We wrote probably like a five page nonsensical mission statement, the first one that we ever did.
Cool.
You know, turned it into a company. We brought a another partner involved more on the business side that could help us come up, and none of us had written a budget before, so just those kinds of very basic business 101 that neither of us had really knew how to do. You know, created a you know, applied for not-for-profit status, and it took a while, and then started just going around the community telling people what we wanted to do, build our own careers meanwhile, and then you know, eventually we applied for some funding through the Knight Foundation.
Through the what funding?
The Knight Foundation.
What is that?
The Knight Foundation is based in Miami. They fund not-for-profits and arts in cities around the country. Cool. I don't know how many. I think they're in 11 or 12 cities. Detroit, okay. St. Paul, Charlotte. But Miami is their headquarters. And I had done some projects for them and gotten to know their leadership. And we applied for something called the Knight Arts Challenge, which is an open call for ideas. You submit 100 words. And we submitted our idea for NewDeco. And when we got to the finals of it, we really were like, this is going to happen. We're if we get this or we don't get this, we took the plunge.
Yeah.
Figured out where we wanted to play. We found a space in Wynwood, which is the arts district of Miami, okay. Which used to be a really tough neighborhood. But then once the artists moved in, it really started to come to life.
Cool.
Anyways, once we figured out where we wanted to play, what we wanted to play, we, like Giacomo mentioned, we invited all the musicians in town that we wanted to play for us. And we said to them, we're not asking for any money. We're just asking for a bit of your time. And so we recorded an introduction video to what NewDeco is. Hmm. And then booked a date at a venue and said, funding, no funding, we're going to do this. We're going to figure it out.
Wow.
And then we did get the funding. We got a $75,000 grant for 2 years to make this happen. And off and running, did our very first concert. Wow.
I think we also, he speaks to this idea, we had a friend in Dallas who started an orchestra. We also got some other great advice. I mean, we looked at a bunch of different ensembles to kind of like look at the ideas and see what other groups were doing. There were several out there doing kind of interesting things. We homogenized our own ensemble and the way we wanted to do it. But there was a guy I spoke to who said, you need to pretend like just one day you flip the lights on and you're there. Website needs to be there.
Right.
Facebook page needs to be there. A video needs to be there. Photos need to be there. You need to have something recorded. So like you just walk into the room, you flip the switch on, and there is NewDeco. It has a presence. It has a life. Uh-huh. So part of this idea of bringing the musicians in was to say, hey, we're going to make this video. We're going to record a couple pieces. We're going to record a couple audio things. We're going to record some video things. We're going to do some interviews. It's a whole day of picture, everything. Like we invested a lot of money in pretending like we were an organization that already existed and was alive. Smart. So that we can go, blip, and then all of a sudden we're there, everything there, photos, audio, video, website, Facebook page, all of it. And that was like a really good piece of advice because it gave us a focus to like really just get it done and make it happen. And he was right. We were in the finals and we were just like, we're going to do this anyway.
Yeah.
And then through that process of just, you know, pulling down from the universe, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
We ended up getting that grant after. But once we flipped the lights on, we're there. We existed.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people was like, oh, just start doing concerts and see what happens. Or don't pay your musicians now. And we're like, no, we wanted to pay the musicians. Yep. We wanted to give them a fee. I mean, actually, Sam was really strong about that. I'm not going to ask anyone ever to do anything for free.
Right.
I'd rather cancel a concert than not pay our musicians because there's a lot of shady things that sometimes musicians have to go through, you know, and Miami's no different. So, you know, we just wanted to really have that set, have the idea of who we are, flip on the switch.
And one thing we actually invested in with some of the early grant money was PR. So we had a lot of articles written about the founding of the orchestra when it came out.
Nice.
And got a lot of press, radio articles, and we ended up selling out our first concert for 200 people. Right. And what ended up happening, it was like what we call now our pilot concert. Because we had gotten so much press, other presenting organizations started reaching out to us. And, you know, after we did our first show, we asked ourselves, okay, for our first season, how many concerts do we really feel like we have have the capability to raise money for and present. And we decided on three, that we were going to do three concerts of two nights each. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening was, because we had gotten so much press around the first concert in Miami, we had different organizations say, we want to present you as well. Oh. So in our first season, we ended up having six or seven concerts, different concerts. One was for the Anti-Defamation League. Cool. One was for a presenting arts organization, the Rhythm Foundation. And it very quickly made us seem and showed that we had a season, and we were here in Miami. We were an arts organization.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, and people exciting. Would discover us at the concert going, what? I didn't even know this existed, as if we'd existed for a long time.
Right.
But
right,
it was really
right,
our first season.
Right.
Know?
Yeah.
So we and also to the entrepreneurship side, like mm-hmm. we never made a decision, even on spending $500, we never made a decision without all consulting each other. Sam, myself, and Dan Baltzegar, who's our unofficial CFO, who really came in and like helped us with all the business side and wrote.
Cool.
And, you know, so we were like I remember having a call. I was in my job in Texas, and Sam's like, "Hey, there's this PR company. They do all this stuff online. They, you know, how much is it?" And he's like, $750. I was like, "Well, I need to talk to them.
Yeah,
if we're gonna spend $750 on them, I want to, you know." And we would never make a big decision on money without, so it was always like this hive mind going on, like decision. And I always felt like if it was one person, it'd be a tougher slog, you know, and you couldn't do it all. But because there was decision making and important things happening in this like circle of trust, because you know, Sam and I have been best friends at that point for 10 whatever years. Mm-hmm. The other guy we brought in, he was one of my best friends from ninth grade.
Wow,
is super successful in business. It's like it's not like who's edging the other person. It was like, nah, we really want to do this for Miami. We want to make it dope and we want it to kill. So let's make the right decisions. And I think that was one of the biggest helps at the beginning, is like never making a decision without one another.
That's great. When did Dan come into the process?
Very early on. Yeah. I mean, really, once we realized
the paperwork that had to be done. Paperwork. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we once we had figured out kind of what it was and what the program was and what the mission was going to be, and then it was like, okay, we need a little bit of help here. Mm. And, you know, just writing that massive application for not-for-profit status was enough to say, you know, help.
Yeah.
And he's a friend of ours who, you know, he visited us in Singapore. He was always musically inclined. He had played the violin in high school. He always wanted to do something in Miami anyway. Cool. Mm. So this was, like, perfect. And then, like, once he was on board, that was it.
You know,
we had the business savvy and experience through him, which was really crucial in hiring our first, you know, employee. It was really crucial in making big decisions. Sam has a knack for this already anyway, for like the business side of things and common sense in the business world. He had that.
Sure. It was like my CEO training, like help. Okay.
Yeah. But then at the same time, like, you know, we all make decisions based on different things, you know, like some of us use our hearts, some of these are minds, some of this combines it all. But the fact that us three were like impenetrable, it helped us so much.
So you're a not-for-profit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What is kind of the future of NewDecca? How are you looking to take it now? Are you in your fifth season? You just completed your fifth season?
We're in the middle of it.
Middle of the fifth season right now. And have you always been featuring artists from season one?
From our first concert. We knew that one, it had to be part of our model. I mean, we kind of fell into this formula, which was our first half would be living composers, newer music. Our second half would begin with a collaboration with a guest artist, and then the concert would end with a suite of music. So the first concert, we did four different composers. We started the second half with a local band named Afro Beta.
Cool.
And then we ended with a Daft Punk suite. Sick. And then we took that formula, and it's really still the formula to this day. We change it up a bit depending on the hall we play in, and now sometimes we'll do a whole half with a guest artist, or we'll do two guest artists. And it changes, but generally speaking, we've kept with this formula.
I'm going to get to the future question in a second. Again, the hall you play in. So you change halls. You don't have a permanent location?
Right. We play in four different concert halls throughout every season.
And,
concert halls, but venues.
Venues. And what are the – are they all kind of seated theater, that kind of thing? Or what kind of venues are they?
So they range in size. The hall that we play – well, the venue that we play in the most of right now, it's called the Citadel, which is state-of-the-art 300-seat, very intimate venue that's broadcast-ready, streaming-ready.
Cool.
The second floor of this building is run by Entercom Media. And it's their showcase for, instead of doing an in-studio performance, they can use that venue. And we're the only other ensemble that's in that venue. Dope. But then that also we also play in the Adrian Arts Center, which is a 2,000 seat performing arts center.
Oh wow!
And then in between that, there's the New World Center, which is in a Frank Gehry state of the art building on Miami Beach that holds 750. It's in the round. It's kind of that in between spot. And then our kind of most left of center spot. It's called the North Beach Band Show, a historical venue on North Beach. Mm-hmm. That it's a combination of seated and standing. It's an outdoor venue.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. It's like our little mini Hollywood Bowl out there.
Yeah. Fun. Yeah. It's a really a lot of fun.
But just to add to that point, we always play to the venue.
Yes.
Okay.
So we tailor make the programs for the venue. We tailor make our sound for the venue. We tailor make the artist even
the kind of artist,
decisions for the venue. Gotcha. And it's funny, you're mentioning the model from the early on. I always thought in the very beginning, the guest artist model was kind of like, a classical symphony will have a soloist, like a violinist or a cellist. Let's make that spot that. Except now it's like a cool guest artist instead of like a classical violinist.
Exactly.
But we've kind of done both now. We've kind of had that mix and match of artists that maybe came from the classical world, like people like Time for Three or Project Trio. But at the same time, you know, that spot has kind of grown and become what it's become. And he's right. Like, if you get Wyclef to come and open up your season, you're going to give him a whole half.
Right.
Same as if Josh Bell comes and plays a concerto with you. You're going to give him the whole half.
Of course.
It's Josh Bell. You know, it's the greatest superstar classical violinist out there. So that's we really think about that in terms of the presentation. Very highly curated, start to finish, and we're tweaking to the last possible second we can
tweak. We're not afraid to call an audible either. We've done it multiple times where we're just saying, you know, we have a program and we start the week and we say, you know, is this piece the best to open up the first half or the beginning of the concert? Is it, you know, for the audience, for the musicians? And what we've done twice this year is we've thrown in, you know, one of what we call our party pieces, like a short piece to settle our musicians, settle the audience, and start the concert, and made that decision the week of, and our musicians go with it, and, you know.
Yeah. It's always a journey, right? Yeah. You want to take the audience member on a journey, and those journeys have peaks and valleys. So sometimes a piece starts off with it's really angular and brash and punchy, but then people need a rest. You need to, like, give the ears, like, a soft moment to, like, chill out for a second. So you bring down the music a little bit, and maybe the second piece is something a little smaller, more intimate. And then you want to finish strong before first half, so you want to take them back up on the climb. But you don't want to peak too early because you have the guest artist and the suite coming later.
Right.
So you're like, you want it to be like this, and then we're going to take a break, and oh my gosh, go get a drink and come back, and then you're going to get blown away.
Cool.
But sometimes that first piece is almost too much to take right away. So there's like almost like a palate, like here we're going to have a little appetizer before we deliver like kind of the first plate of this entire program.
And Giacomo actually came up with the idea when we started playing in the Arts Center in the big venue to actually reverse the form a bit, and which was when we started doing this, the artist to end the program, but then we would put the suite of music to begin the program.
Oh.
Yeah, and kind of, and that had mixed results, I would say, depending on what the rest of the program was. When we did our Queen suite, we followed that with Stravinsky's Petrushka, which was kind of jagged for our musicians and made us kind of question that and adjust that in moving forward. And
Is Stravinsky still alive?
No.
I thought you did only living composers.
20th and 21st century composers is,
got
is
it.
Kind
Not
of
living
the realm we're in.
Yeah.
I mean, the majority is living composers.
Okay.
But where, you know, Stravinsky was a stretch, and we want to dive back into him again at some point. But like Ravel, Gershwin, Copland, Bernstein, all these early 20th century masters who kind of helped form the American sound.
Right.
You know, minimalist composers like John Adams and Terry Riley. You know, these are all people, Steve Reich, you know, these are all people we wanted to really celebrate as well.
Cool.
And one of the rules that we came up with for our organization is that if we were going to do any composers that were prior to the 20th century, they would have to be reimagined. So we do Bach.
Wait, you blasphemy! Oh my gosh!
So,
what? Yeah. Wait, explain. So you arrange, you rearrange Bach?
Yes, yeah, so we do a Bach we call it Toccata e Fuga, and it's a Latin, it's like a Miami version of Bach's Toccata and Fugue.
Damn.
We've done Bizet this year.
It's one of our party pieces.
Yeah.
It's one of the pieces that makes
waves. We did a holiday show this year, and we did a reimagination of the Nutcracker, which was immensely successful with our audience.
Cool.
Yeah.
So you do, so how much Miami kind of seeps into the arrangements and like the style and what you decide to do?
I mean, I think every reimagination we do always has a little bit of Miami. I mean, that's where we are. Miami's a melting pot. Yeah. Miami's got an edge. I'm writing with Miami-based players. There's always that kind of there's always like a little bit of an edgy element into it. And you know, well, we just did Fleetwood Mac, and Don't Stop was an Afrobeat version of Don't Stop. You know, when we did the Waltz of the Flowers became a very Latinized Miami version of it, and we did the Nutcracker.
Cool.
So we feel there'll always be some sort of Miami element in anything that we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like world music too. Like, yeah. Or the way the rhythm section and the hybrid part of the ensemble has kind of developed is, of course, we have a drummer and he can slay and do whatever.
Yeah.
But he always asked about having someone else to kind of fill in, thicken things up, make things different. So we have this other guy, Brian Potts, who plays like congas, you know, bongos and shakers and tools. And he I mean, I remember
the one. Builds his own percussion.
He builds his own percussion. I remember it was like, we were doing trap music and, you know, like he's hitting this like metal tin can. It's like,
It was like a metal can that he made sound like an 808.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's like an 808 snare that he built from a metal can.
And then
can.
What's his name of the tambourine he uses? The bum that has that like, there's a tambourine that has like a plug-in, so it sounds like a doom, 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 but it's a tambourine.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's bombero, bandero.
Bandero.
Yeah. And he has like a whole group. So it just very creative guys that told us, if we're working together, we can make some crazy percussion sounds and we can really open this up in a new way. And it got to the point where it's like really magical.
It's same on the synthesizer end. Like we have like a synth guy who, you know, he's playing on Moog, or I'm playing on Prophet, and it's like, creating, you know, we give him the flexibility to create his own sounds for the piece and give him the time throughout the week. You know, sometimes we'll hear stuff come out of the rhythm section and Giacomo was raising his eyebrow, but we give them that flexibility. Guitar player like put on this like mod ring and it's like you know, for but we give them that time because that creative element amongst the musicians, and even with our winds and brass players, like some, oh, you mind if I take that down an octave, or like, you know, I always say that like the arrangement is a reference point, and try stuff and don't be afraid, like as a section, if you wanna change this articulation, change this note. Like that, like the creative aspect is something we really push, and we want our players to feel that freedom, because I mean that collective element is really where the magic happens.
That's really interesting. So I'm assuming you're at all the rehearsals.
Yes.
Right. And so I mean that's quite unique, where the orchestra is collaborating with not just the director, not with each other, but with the arranger right there.
Yeah.
Composer, arranger. All right there. And so that it is a full, I mean, that kind of seems like what New Deco's identity is.
Yeah.
I mean, that feels like New Deco's identity right there, is this full-on collaboration collectively
together. So it used to be, just to clarify, that the first 3 years, all of the suites were I did by myself. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty taxing. And it's like, you know, you don't want to find yourself repeating yourself. And and then once we started bringing these rhythm section players, that they expressed interest in being part of the writing process.
Yeah.
And once we started all working together on these pieces, I mean, I became more, I mean, I'm you know, sitting at the computer in Sibelius and doing all the inputting and making the decisions, but it's almost like being the executive producer and taking these ideas in. And what that led to was freshening up of all these pieces, but also more buy-in from the players as well. Like once they started buying into the creative process instead of just coming in and working for the arranger, being part of it, it opened up everything. And
can I speak to that a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah. Another thing that developed because of that was trust between not only his collaborators on the music, but then the orchestra, like, oh, all these guys wrote this piece together. So like our drummer sometimes will say things to strings, and our concertmaster may say something to the electric bass player. I mean, communication and trust is so open now. Huh. I mean, obviously we're the leaders. I'm the guy on the podium. Sure. I've got to make the ultimate decision. Sometimes I have to make a quick one.
Yeah.
But the trust, it's almost, I would say, getting to a point like, our trumpet player will sometimes pull out a flugel like add mutes, and I'm like, I don't even like know anymore until like the show. I'm like, oh, he's on a flugel, because it seems so right.
Yeah.
And it's like we've created this environment for like a musical utopia. We want people to like really have the buy-in, as he says, and we've tried all kinds of different ways to get the buy-in, because, you know, a paycheck's a paycheck, anyone's.
Right.
But like when you have real buy-in and people are really committed with their heart and soul to something, you can create this environment, like this musical utopia, where creativity flows back and forth. You can try things here and there. Yeah. There's no two solos are the same. And it sometimes you're on the edge of your seat, like, oh God, what's gonna happen? Who's gonna do what? But then usually you're like, whoa, that was like crazy magical that we never even expected would happen.
It's like a band.
It's a band. Consider ourselves a band.
Yeah. I
mean, but it's like a 30-piece band.
Right. But that's so cool that there's this mutual respect and collaboration amongst everybody, which I mean
can't happen overnight.
Right, I would imagine.
It took 5 years to get to where we are, and it'll be another 5 before we get to where we're
going
to go, you know?
I would be very surprised if this exists in this kind of capacity anywhere else, where there's this kind of collaboration amongst the orchestra, the arranger, and the conductor. I mean, that's, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's
I think there's exciting. Some groups that like all contribute and talk. There's actually a group out here called Kaleidoscope that like there's no conductor.
Okay.
And so their rehearsal's a little longer, but they figure it out and talk. I think there's ways to do it.
Yeah.
You know, string quartets, historically, there was always like
sure.
communication, people yes. talk. But to have
that's
it
for people,
at,
right.
exactly. Yeah, but to yeah. have it at the level, you're mm-hmm. right. It's I don't know of another institution mm-hmm. that can do something like that.
Well, and also, I mean, to your guys' credit, it takes removing a lot of your ego from the equation, because a lot of conductors, as we know, you know, that's the, yep. the ego plays a lot into it, and they like
what
to
are you
be and like to just like, you know, that's like the humility that, yeah. that comes into it, where you understand for the greater good of what Nudeco is. This is kind of what makes you better.
It also speaks to like legacy as well, because ultimately, you know, for me, I you know, on the writing side, I don't want to just it to be perceived as it's just all about Sam Hyken's music. Mm-hmm. We want the music to be by Nudeco, you know,
yes,
that it lives beyond Giacomo and I. You know, after you know, when we don't want this to be something that's just Giacomo and I, and if mm-hmm. it doesn't exist outside of us.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I feel like Nudeco. Is starting to have, if not already, but it's really having a sound.
Mm. Yes.
And so, like, I was listening to your new record, which is phenomenal, by the way. And it has, it's so powerful. Mm. It's so intense. And it's great. I mean, yeah. it's phenomenal. But, yeah, but it's like, it has this sound. What?
We joked with our producer, Kishibashi. He's like, this is a very masculine album.
Music by a bunch of dudes done by a bunch of dudes.
You know, it's right. It hits you in the face. It's, you know, it's great. But this is like the sound. And that's like, you know, getting back to that, what is the Nudeco identity and what is Nudeco all about? That, you know, I think everything we've been going through, it makes a lot of sense.
I also feel like we each have a job to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if the musicians really understand that their role is to take the music they come on, bring their attention, creativity to it, that's their job. My job is to hold it all together. Sam's job is to write the best he can. Mm-hmm. You know, we all are, no one's higher or lower, you know, we're elevating all music, right? Mm. Whether it's a reimagining of Bizet and Bach or Copland and Bernstein and Gershwin or a living composer or Fleetwood Mac or Kishibashi. Yes. We're trying to lift everything up.
All music valued equally.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. and so that's the same way with the musicians. Like everyone, we only have one oboe player. She's the only one that can play that oboe that way. Yeah. We only have one bass player who plays the way he plays. Like cool. When we come together, we're going to create a certain sound that week that can never be replicated because it's a certain amount of people doing a certain thing. Mm. And if you, like you speak about ego, if everyone understands that, leaves their hat at the ego hat at the door and comes in and says, I have a job to do, which is be as prepared as I can on everything we're going to conduct mm-hmm. and have a vision for the architecture of the music. You know, the musicians is to be as prepared as they can and know what they can know, and we provide the tools for that. Sam is to write and be, you know, it's, we all have a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
No one's more, sure, it's more stressful on our end, but mm-hmm. it doesn't mean it's more important or valuable.
Mm.
And if we all come to the table with this idea that we're all inclusive here to make something really special, mm-hmm. I feel like that's the cultivation we really worked hard the last couple of years to build.
Love that. I want to talk about a little bit of the community aspect of Nudeco's involvement in kind of the community work that you do. Mm-hmm. You said you had, so yeah, just speak to that kind of the community involvement in Miami.
So Giacomo and I knew from the very beginning, mm-hmm. education and outreach, and that work has always been important to both of us. Both of us, when we were at Juilliard at different times, were really involved in the education outreach department. Mm-hmm. Both of us played in quintets that went into old age homes and did education concerts, et cetera. So it was something mm-hmm. really important. And we did it from the very beginning. Mm. At our very first concert, we had a relationship with a magnet school and invited them to our dress rehearsal and did a side-by-side after that.
Cool.
Now, that's developed into an education program we call Nudeco Imagination, which consists of both education concerts that we do at the Seminole Theater in Homestead, where Giacomo is from. He can speak to that a bit. But then when we do our shows at the Arch Center, we'll also bus in kids during that week and do play for like 4,000 kids, some from our repertoire designed around a theme.
Cool.
In addition to that, at our big halls, it's a program that we started this year. That we call Nudeco Access, that we give away 400 tickets to underserved communities.
Nice.
So our concerts are more inclusive. Mm. Then we'd also do in-school concerts as well with our smaller group. And finally, this year, we're launching our very own youth orchestra that we're calling Nudeco Next.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. So let's talk about that. What does that look like? What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, honestly, when we perform for kids, and I'll just really quick dive in on the Homestead, because that's where we started with these education concerts.
Yeah.
Homestead hadn't had an orchestra visit down there in over 40 years. Wow. Their hall had just reopened. It's a migrant community full of immigrants and migrants who are totally undocumented. And, you know, we knew that if we stayed in the Miami area, that's the more sexy thing to do, like to go, you know, and play around Miami. But we wanted to go south because not only was I from there, but it just felt like the right thing for us to do to give back to these kids. And what we noticed is that a lot of those kids got to know what an orchestra is through us. And we started getting feedback, like these kids were like really into what we're doing. And then some of them would actually have seen us in junior high, go and study with people at New World School of the Arts that are members of the orchestra. And they were like, wow, they saw an education. It was really starting, the seeds were starting to plant.
Yeah.
And then, you know, honestly, we've always wanted to do a youth orchestra, but we knew that we had to get to a certain place with where we are to be able to do it. And, you know, what we wanted to do is bring kids together like we've brought our community together. We have become this access point for the community, for people who may be interested in Daft Punk, but then they get to hear new music by a living composer. People who are really into new music by a living composer are going to come and hear, you know, Kishibashi do his thing. And so we become this like access point, like a gravitational pull for all these people who have different, you know, aesthetics and what they like in music, but through the vehicle of the orchestra. We want to do that for the kids. We want to bring kids from schools that maybe they're just in a jazz band. They never get to work with string players. We want to bring in kids who play in youth orchestras and play a string instrument, but they may love Kanye West, you know? So why not come in and get to vibe out with some kids who from another school who never get to work with an orchestra? So basically the same principle and model of bringing people together through the style of music making we do, we wanted to do with the youth orchestra. But also have elements of like, you know, community leadership, entrepreneurship, health and wellness. You know, we're adding yoga and meditation, and you know, we're teaching these kids skills, life skills that we know that most, at least to my knowledge, I don't think a lot of classical music conservatories really dive into that stuff. They just teach you how to play your instrument really well, and they give you the skills that they know how to give you so you can go and have your own career. But we want to give kids these options right now in high school to show them, hey, if you do this, you can become a writer, you can become an arranger, you can work with an orchestra, you can work with a band. It's all up to you what you really want to do, what your heart is all about. But we have a lot of musicians in our group who are like that anyway. They're very savvy. They do a lot of different things. So we want to give them all these tools, not only in the music making side, but also on the entrepreneurship, health and wellness side.
And so they can, creativity as well. Like,
right.
Improv. One thing that we're doing, improvisation also. Collective composition. So the creativity, the health and wellness, the flexibility in styles, and just getting kids to play together that don't usually get to play together.
Nice. So when does that launch?
In a few weeks.
We're
auditioning kids right now. We're putting the orchestra together.
Are you leading it, Giacomo?
I'll come in the last couple of days and help with the concert. I think it's bigger than me. You know, we want to bring in a lot of like really talented instructors, and we've had some people come in and help us get the sort of like the bones together, because this is a big project and we want to do it the right way. So it's really, we're doing an intensive, like a spring break intensive, and everything's kind of building toward that. Down the road, it would be great if we had multiple weeks a year. But we just want to kind of get the pilot off the ground right now. I'll come in, of course, conduct the concert and give them my vibe. But like, I think it's really important that they learn how to make music together and have instruction that's like really hands-on. I think this idea that a kid shows up one day a week and sits in the back of a violin section and plays 2 hours with an orchestra while a conductor is telling them what to do is good and it has its place. But I think we want to give them a very hands-on, like, you know, deep dive into what it is to be a great team member. You know, music is diplomacy. At the end of the day, it's a give and take, and there's no greater, higher musical human sort of connection that people can make than sharing music together. It's an unspoken language. It's another language. Artists, they talked about it at the Grammys, like music pulls people together and allows them to communicate in ways they don't get to do. We hope to do that through this youth orchestra and bring these kids together in a way so they can learn how to start talking to other people and learn that, like, you know, maybe your way isn't the highway. You know, like, let's all share and grow and adapt and be flexible. I mean, that's what I've learned leading NewDeco. I mean, it's affected my conducting tremendously because, you know, a lot of what I do is more than just giving time beats. You know, it's expression, it's architecture, it's listening, it's getting feedback from the group. What is the group really telling me as I'm conducting it? They want to slow down or they want to go faster. Go with it. Let's see what happens, you know, and keeping kids' ears open and keeping their emotional, I don't know, or open to what is possible, I think is a really beautiful thing that they can carry with them as they move forward in their lives and careers.
Amazing. Well, Giacomo, Sam, I have one final question for you guys that I ask everyone who comes on the show. I'm going to ask you each individually to so you can answer individually.
You go first, so I have more time.
What does it mean to you to make it in the new music business?
Ooh, what does it mean to make it? We used to always joke, fake it till you make it.
Okay.
I feel just very blessed and honored that I've been given a gift that I'm able to share with people. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what make it or not make it is. I mean, I have a wonderful life with great collaborators and wonderful friends. I feel supported. I, you know, obviously make enough money to live and have a certain lifestyle that I appreciate right now. Mm-hmm. It was never about the money for me per se, but I was always about like creating something that you have some ownership in. And I think for me, the ownership stake of New Deco just means so much. You know, as a guest conductor, I go around and conduct orchestras, and it's great. I get to work with these amazing ensembles and institutions that, like, really are tremendous and kind of like, wow, that's a really great accomplishment from a personal standpoint.
Yeah.
But to create something like a baby from the very beginning and watch it grow and see where it grows into and how it's spread its own ways, you know, you plant a seed and then that seed grows in different directions. To sit back and now see where that's going and to like kind of shape it and when it needs to be shaped and also let it go when it needs to be going, it's changed me as a human and it's made me more open and just really enjoying life in a new, more deep, profound way than it would be if I'm just chasing the dream to conduct every orchestra I want to conduct. It just, that's part of it. And I love that. And I get feedback from that. But the reality is to have this baby and have it grow for me, that's making it, you
amazing.
Know? Yeah.
Great.
So for me, you know, Giacomo and I, we've talked about this, which is, you know, especially in today's world, things come so fast and the moments of accomplishment, like for us as individuals, don't always feel like they last. But what's so wonderful about New Deco is we're constantly feeling like we're giving other people amazing experiences, like the guest artists or our own musicians. And those feelings of giving others amazing moments is what keeps us going. Mm. And I feel like that's what's really making it in this new industry today.
Nice.
We're really in a renaissance. The ability to create is at everybody's fingertips now. We were just talking about this with TikTok and everything. Mm-hmm. Anybody can be an artist, and it's really, we're living in a renaissance. So, so you know, by providing these meaningful experiences for others, it's how I feel personally about what it means to make it.
Right on. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show.
Sorry.
And I can't wait to get to Miami and check out a concert.
Come down, man. Have some fun.
All right.
That's a game.
Thanks, Ari.
Yeah, for sure. All right.
Thanks, brother.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a distribution service that can get your music into all the DSPs like Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram. Over a million artists have used DistroKid. I'm one of those artists. I've used DistroKid to get my music out, distribute some of my songs. As you know, as I look into all of these distribution services, I test them out. And DistroKid is great. They offer a ton of features, annual fee, unlimited uploads, and you keep 100% of your royalties. Check out distrokid.com.